This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise. Most of us might not think of parking as a sustainability issue, but our guest this week on Sea Change Radio, Professor Donald Shoup, has spent the better part of his career considering the environmental impact of free parking. Dr. Shoup's insights are leading urban planning in a new, more sustainable direction and pushing our thinking about this convenience most tend to take for granted. Today on Sea Change Radio, the price of free parking. Our guest today on Sea Change Radio is Professor Donald Shoup. He's a professor of urban planning at UCLA in Los Angeles. Professor Shoup has extensively studied parking as a key link between transportation and land use, with important consequences for cities, the economy, and the environment. His influential book, The High Cost of Free Parking, is leading a growing number of cities to charge fair market prices for curb parking, dedicate the resulting revenue to finance public services in the metered districts, and reduce or remove off-street parking requirements. Professor Shoup is a fellow of the American Institute of Certified Planners. He's been a visiting scholar at Cambridge University and the World Bank, and has served as director of the Institute of Transportation Studies and chair of the Department of Urban Planning at UCLA. Professor Shoup, thank you so much for being with us today on Sea Change Radio.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Why don't you introduce our listeners first to your general thesis behind the high cost of free parking?
Well, American motorists park free at the end of 99% of their vehicle trips. Usually it doesn't seem that way to us when we're visiting a downtown area, but so many trips in the suburbs end up at a mall or a shopping center or a grocery store with free parking that we're used to free parking at most of our trips, either on street or off street. But just because the motorist doesn't pay for parking doesn't mean that the cost goes away. The cost is really paid by everybody, even people who are too poor to own a car. The cost of parking gets included in the cost of restaurant meals or movie tickets or stuff you buy in the store. So with every transaction you make, a little bit of the money gets siphoned off to pay for parking. And that's how we get to park free at the end of our vehicle trips. So the parking is free to us only in our role as a driver, but we pay for parking in every other role we have in society, as a taxpayer, as an employer, as an employee, as a shopper, a diner, every other role in life that we have, we pay for parking.
Parking obviously is something that people like to get for free. Since the advent of the automotive, it's kind of been one of these, monopoly is one of our classic board games, and of course there's a free parking space right there, so but there's not a free hotel room, so we obviously it's part of the American lore to some degree, right?
Well, everybody likes to park free, including me, but that doesn't mean we should elevate it to a public policy and say that everybody ought to park free. We have free parking and expensive housing. I think we have our priorities the wrong way around. Although parking seems a small element in our lives, it isn't just that we're spending a lot of money overseas to buy oil for our cars so we can drive free to shopping centers to buy goods that are imported from China. There are other problems as well. I think that free parking almost everywhere makes driving the obvious way to travel. We may curse traffic and breathe exhaust and stare at taillights as we're going to where we're going, but we'll park free when we get there. And that free parking certainly encourages us to drive alone. I think that Federal statistics show that 87% of all our trips in the United States are made by motor vehicle. And I mean, it'd be hard to get that any higher unless we eliminated walking.
You say at one point in your book, The High Cost of Free Parking, that parking is the unstudied link between transportation and land use. And obviously, you've dedicated your career largely to understanding parking in a more profound way than most municipalities. What's the impact of all this free parking on most municipalities?
Well, parking is both a transportation element and it's a big land use. That it's parking is the single biggest land use in any city. That there's more space devoted to parking than there is to housing, or to offices, or to factories, or anything else. And one reason for this is that almost every city has an elaborate set of minimum parking requirements for every land use. If you want to build a movie theater, you might have to have 6 parking spaces per 1,000 square feet. Or if you want to have a restaurant, you have to have 20 spaces per 1,000 square feet. And really, you can't build or open any restaurant unless you have the required parking. And all of this required parking spreads everything out. It makes walking less pleasant because you're walking past large parking lots. It makes it very difficult to cluster a lot of activities in the kind of areas that everybody likes to walk around in. So I think it's the minimum parking requirements in cities' zoning laws that have made America look the way it does, which is a paradise for cars, but it's got problems for people.
About the restaurants, I read in your book that, I forget the exact ratio.
Parking lot at a restaurant is typically 3 times bigger than the restaurant itself.
That was stunning to me. You don't even think about that. You just go into the parking lot, you park, and you sit down, you eat your meal. But you forget that most of the space of this property owner or leaser is being taken up by the car you just parked.
Well, that's right. Often, only a quarter of the site goes for the restaurant and 3/4 of the site goes for parking. And often the parking is empty or certainly underused. Whenever cities do reduce or remove the parking requirements for restaurants, often there's an explosion of restaurants as the buildings are restored and reopened as restaurants. But only if you could do it without the required parking.
I was talking to my father-in-law recently about parking, and as I was reading your book, and he said, and he's a listener of the show, so you should be diplomatic in your answer here, but he said, why should you pay for parking when you've paid for the sidewalk, the curbs, pavement, traffic, lights, drainage, etc.? What would you say to critics of people who want to regulate parking, such as yourself?
Well, I don't want to regulate parking so much as to deregulate it. I would say that what we have in the United States is an elaborate set of regulations that, a nunnery would require 1 parking space for 10 nuns, or a nail salon would require 5 parking spaces per 1,000 square feet. That there is the 10,000 commandments for minimum parking requirements. And if you want to deregulate, I think the place to start is with parking. I think these parking requirements that we do have interfered in the market so much that they have changed the way we live. And I don't think the way we live now is sustainable. I don't see why people would deplore what's happening in the Gulf of Mexico and then say we need lots of free parking and think that there's no connection between the two.
We have to look at this as a global issue, not just not in my backyard, I don't want to pay for parking kind of issue.
Well, I don't want to pay for parking, and neither does anybody else. But you don't want to pay for gasoline, and you don't want to pay for insurance, and you don't want to pay for anything, really. That parking is the big exception. That it's very expensive, and we expect to get it for free. Say for a new parking space at UCLA, We have 25,000 parking spaces on campus. The most recent ones are costing $30,000 a space. Now, how many of our students have $30,000 to their names? How many people in the United States have a net worth of greater than $30,000? That especially low-income people, their assets are less than $30,000, and yet we want to arrange our world so that everybody can have a $30,000 parking space so they can drive and park their, you know, $3,000 car for free. I think it's twisted our lives out of shape.
What are we going to tell Jerry about the car?
I don't know.
All right, start looking for spaces.
Oh, you're never going to find a space on Jerry's block. Just put in a garage.
Look, I have my system. First, I look for the dream spot right in front of the door, then I slowly expand out in concentric circles.
No, come on, George, please put it in a garage. I don't want to spend an hour looking for a space.
Can't park in a garage.
Why?
I don't know. I just can't. Nobody in my family can pay for parking. It's a sickness. My father never paid for parking. My mother, my brother, nobody. We can't do it.
I'll pay for it.
You don't understand. Garage. Can't even pull in there. It's like going to a prostitute. Why should I pay when if I apply myself, maybe I could get it for free?
Now, more of our discussion with Dr. Donald Shoup, the author of The High Cost of Free Parking, on Sea Change Radio. I found this quote in your book about cruising, which is driving around looking for parking. Cruising is individually rational because it saves the driver some money for parking, but is collectively irrational because it takes time, congests traffic, wastes fuel, and pollutes the air. Now, it seems to me that statement captures a basic truth that applies to multiple realms of the environmental movement and the push to more sustainable practices.
One of the things that I do recommend is that cities should charge the right price for curb parking. And by right price, I mean the price at the meter that would lead to about 85% occupancy most of the time. Now, that 85% occupancy means that the space will be well used, that they'll be almost full. But the 15% vacancy rate is key. It means that anybody who comes to a block sees one or two vacant spaces there, and they won't have to drive around hunting for a space. The price would vary throughout the day, but the reason it varies is to keep about 15% of the spaces vacant. There wouldn't be any driving around hunting for parking. And we did do studies of how much traffic is driving around, and in one little business district in Los Angeles, about 15 blocks, there's almost a million miles of travel a year, vehicle travel a year, hunting for underpriced curb parking. And that's travel that people don't want to make. It's driving that people don't want to do.
So this 15 block area is a million miles a year of cruising for parking?
That's right.
That's astounding.
Think about it carefully, it isn't astounding. The average time to find a space was only 3 minutes, so that's not too much. That's just 2.5 times around the block to find the space. But if we did that, which is what we found when we cruised, everybody else is probably doing it as well. And if you think every single person who's parking on average creates a half a mile of travel hunting for the space, waiting for somebody to pull out so you can pull in, it just adds up. And it's adding up everywhere, all over the world.
Let's cruise away from here. Back to our conversation with UCLA urban planning professor and parking expert Donald Shoup on Sea Change Radio. Let's focus on a city that hasn't really done enough to analyze its parking problem, in your estimation.
There's an interesting comparison between downtown Los Angeles and downtown San Francisco. You've probably heard of Disney Hall, the great new concert hall in Los Angeles. Well, LA requires for a new concert hall downtown, as a minimum, 50 times more parking spaces than San Francisco allows as the maximum. And that's why Disney Hall has a $125 million parking garage underneath it, which was built 7 years before they raised the money to build Disney Hall. The equivalent concert hall in San Francisco has no parking.
This is what you're talking about, the unstudied link, is that people really don't know what they're doing because you see completely opposite methodologies being applied.
Well, that's right. And you'd think in any real science, if they looked and found such diametrically different policies, they'd say, well, what's going on?
So you think there's even though people are complaining in all of these cities about parking, there's a real link between the way they go about their policies in parking and the livability?
I think so. In downtown Los Angeles, every building has to have its own parking supply underneath it or beside it. In San Francisco, there are lots of buildings without any parking at all. And the people can park in public parking structures. They have to pay, of course. But when they get out of their car, it's a much better environment. In Los Angeles, if you go to a concert at Disney Hall, you probably drive right into the underground garage. You take the escalator cascade into the lobby, and you never set foot on a sidewalk before or after the concert. After the concert, you go right back down to the garage and you leave. Because if you go out on the sidewalk, you'll be almost alone.
So the cities that are making progress, why is that happening in those cities? And what can be done to promote these types of policy changes in your mind?
That gives me an opening to mention what San Francisco is doing and what I think all cities ought to be doing. They're embarking on this policy of setting the prices for curb parking so that nobody can say there's a shortage in North Beach. Maybe they don't want to pay what the meter charges, but nobody can say that there's a shortage. So wherever you go, you'll see the parking is not difficult. And what has made this a popular policy in some cities is that they use the meter revenue to increase public spending on the metered streets. That is, the money doesn't disappear into the general fund. It gets returned to clean the sidewalks, to plant street trees, to put in historic light fixtures, to clean up the alleys. For example, in Old Pasadena, which used to be a commercial slum here in Southern California, they put in meters with all of the meter revenue going back to the neighborhood, and they use it to completely rebuild the sidewalks. They have additional public security. So Old Pasadena went from a commercial skid row into one of the most desirable destinations in Southern California. 30,000 people on a weekend go to Old Pasadena just to walk around because it's such a delightful area.
What do you think are the prerequisites that need to be in place for the solutions that you're talking about to be applied?
Well, it helps to have seen a city where they do have this policy, like Pasadena or Redwood City. Parts of Washington, D.C. have it now.
But I think I'm talking a little bit more if we compare, an impoverished city that's really struggling from the recent downturn in the economy, like Detroit, versus a city like San Francisco or another one that you think has benefited from reexamining their parking policies.
Parking policy is not a silver bullet, but we shouldn't expect anything to be a silver bullet. What we need is a silver buckshot, and parking is one of these effective buckshot. The key thing is to treat parking like we treat many other things. You pay for what you get. I don't think America became a great nation by being a nation of freeloaders. But when it comes to parking, we all want to be freeloaders. We all want to park free at someone else's expense. And that someone else is everybody. I think when it comes to parking, staunch conservatives become ardent communists. You know, they want to be have it collectively paid for and social responsibility. And rational people quickly become very irrational. So it's why it's hard to talk to many people about Parkingist policy, especially when you're talking about charging them for parking spaces. If half the spaces are empty, the price is simply too high. And I think there are large parts of Los Angeles where the price of curb parking is now too high because you see a lot of empty spaces at the meters. So I think in many cases it would mean a lower price and you'd get more revenue and you'd actually get more customers in the adjacent stores. I mean, they should lower the price and, as they did in Redwood City, remove the time limit altogether. So I think that we could get much more effective use of our curb parking if we get the price of curb parking right.
Well, it's a paved paradise. They put up a parking lot with a big hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Now, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
We're speaking with Donald Shoup, the author of The High Cost of Free Parking. He's also a professor of urban planning at UCLA. It's obviously overlooked, but people think about parking constantly in their day. And what do you think about some of the ticketing policies? Because that can, the give and take between the citizen and the municipality can be turned into a hostile relationship. The meters and people always being worried about filling their meters, the disproportionate tickets too, over just a few minutes of a meter overage can lead to this hostility between meter maids and the municipality on the whole sometimes. What do you think is a fair way to enforce metered parking?
Well, I think you've got a key issue there. If you are going to charge for curb parking, you want to make sure that people are paying. But you shouldn't be too over-aggressive in ticketing. The two policies I like, one in Redwood City and in some other places, that there's no time limit on parking. You can pay for as long as you want to park. And now that people can use credit cards at parking meters, it turns out that they often pay for longer than they expect to stay just to make sure that they won't get a ticket. But the other policy that I would recommend is quite rare, but it's growing. I think a graduated parking fine system where the occasional offenders pay nothing and get only warnings, but the frequent offenders will end up paying a lot.
Well, I like that solution. I think the evolution of technology with enforcement is given options on both sides of it. For example, I know that one thing that drives people crazy and can lead to real confrontations on the street is when somebody's right there willing to move their car, but the person has already, the meter maid has already started to write their ticket and the city has a policy saying they aren't technically allowed to do it, to rip that ticket up. The person then has to go appeal the case and go through a whole litigious wrangle to try to get out of this ticket. That can be solved by this new technology in a lot of ways, right?
Yes, and I think cities ought to be very generous about canceling a ticket if the owner comes, you know, before the enforcement officer has left. The technology is really quite wonderful, both for managing curb parking and for making sure that people pay. There's a new technology developed largely in the Bay Area. In this country, called occupancy sensors, which are, you know, about the size of a little pocket calculator, and they sense the change in the Earth's magnetic field when there are a couple of tons of metal above them. So they put these in the pavement, and they're battery powered, and they communicate with the headquarters in real time whether the space is occupied or not. And the multi-space meters that so many cities now have communicate whether the space is paid for or not. So the city has, in real time, the data on which blocks have a lot of occupancy, but not many people paying. So the meter people would just go to those blocks. They wouldn't just roam around looking for violations. They would go to where there's the highest number of violators.
Professor Shoup, so when I was reading your book, I found it fascinating in a lot of ways, but also it linked to me the fact that I don't like looking for parking. This isn't a very pleasant part of our car ownership experience. You just want to put it out of sight and out of mind once you're out of the car. So how did you get passionate about parking, and how do you stick to something that obviously hasn't been solved yet?
Well, I came at it from the issue of fairness. I was hired by the California Transportation Commission to write a piece on equity in transportation planning. And the first thing I noticed was that so many employers offer free parking to their employees. It sounds like a very generous offer, and who could complain about that? But the problem is that if you offer free parking to every employee, you're offering a subsidy to drivers and nothing to anybody else. If somebody bicycled or walked or took the bus to work, you don't give them anything, but you do give free parking. So that's unfair, it seems to me, especially because the lower income employees are less likely to drive and more likely to ride the bus. And also women are more likely to ride the bus to work than men are. So, and minorities are more likely to ride the bus. So I think it just doesn't seem fair. But I don't recommend charging everybody for parking. What I did recommend, and what is taken off in some places, is parking cash out, is that if you offer free parking, you have to offer the people who don't drive the same subsidy, the equivalent subsidy. So you can cash out your parking subsidy. If I decide not to drive to work, I could get $100 a month for walking or bicycling or carpooling or taking the bus or whatever. So the employer expands the offer from free parking or nothing to free parking or its cash value. And I think that's very fair. I think it treats everybody equally. Some people may say, well, gee, if I could have $100 a month rather than the parking space, I'll begin bicycling to work or carpooling or something like that. So not only would it be fair, but it would be more aligned with our goals as a nation to reduce unnecessary driving. The parking cash out can have some surprising effects. One of my students told me that his girlfriend had moved into a pretty expensive apartment in downtown Los Angeles, and he told his girlfriend that he thought she was overpaying for rent. And she said that, well, yes, it is expensive, but the law firm I work for offered me free parking, or if I didn't take the free parking, $150 a month, which is what it cost them to rent the parking. So I took the cash, and I used that as a rent subsidy. So here is a simple policy of parking cash out, which sounds like it would get people out of their car, but also change where she lived. She walks to work from her downtown apartment. Now, in LA, they've been trying for years to get more people to live downtown, but one little change in the transportation policy, the simple, fair idea of parking cash out, made somebody decide to move from the suburbs to downtown so she could walk to work. I just don't see why people think that the space for the car should be free, but the space for the human should be very expensive. I mean, we just got it the wrong way around.
Well, we usually don't think of parking as part of the green movement, but you're opening a lot of eyes, Professor Shoup, and we really thank you for the work you're doing and for taking the time to walk us through it today on Sea Change Radio.
Well, I enjoyed it. Thanks for inviting me.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our theme music is by Sanford Lewis. Additional music by Smokey Robinson, Antti Balas, Keb Mo, and Alex Wise. We also heard an excerpt from Seinfeld from 1992. And special thanks to Professor Donald Shoup. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.